WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Drew Carey is the latest stand-up comic to have both a hit sitcom and a best-selling book. His book, Dirty Jokes and Beer, is a collection of some very funny jokes, humorous observations, personal reminiscences, and some not-so-funny stuff about his suicide attempts and his father's death. His TV character is a variation of his comedy club persona. The TV Drew Carey is a likable, overweight, out-of-shape working stiff in Cleveland. Much of the show takes place in the personnel office of the department store where the character works. Part of what makes this character so winning is how untrendy he looks in his crew cut and black glasses. I talk with Drew Carey about his TV show, his book, and, of course, Dirty Jokes. One of the chapters in your book is really a scream. It's 101 very funny jokes about the male member.
Yeah.
I'm not
yeah,
sure
that's
how
not
to
what
put
it's
it.
Called, but the, yeah.
That's, it's not what you
that's
call
a good
it.
Way to, that's a good way to put it for radio, sure.
Yeah. And these jokes are really funny.
Yeah, my friends and I started doing them. I started with John Campanera on The Good Life when he showed me his one day as a joke. And I said, what do you call that? And I was making jokes about, you know, mine is so big that, and he went, oh yeah, well, mine is so big that. And we started making up these jokes. And I started remembering all of them in my head. And every time my friends would get together and we'd mention this thing, they'd always add in their own jokes. Everybody thought it was so funny, they'd try to add in their own jokes. And I started writing all these down, and pretty soon I had 101 of them. And most all of them I wrote myself. A lot of them came from my friends, and I credit them in the book. But they're really funny.
Can you tell a couple of them?
It's so big, it's right behind you. It's so big, there's still snow on it in the summertime. It's so big. oh, wow, I'm trying to clean these up for the radio. It's so big it graduated a year ahead of me from high school. It's so big, Stephen Hawking has a theory about it. I love that one. It's so big, it has an opening act. It's so big, it only tips with hundreds. It's so big, it contains billions and billions of stars. It's so big.
It doesn't return Spielberg's calls.
It doesn't return Spielberg's calls. That's pretty big.
Wow, that's really funny.
It's so big, my mother was in labor for 3 extra days.
Oh, there's another joke I have to ask you to tell. This is the one about the beautiful woman who compliments the comic. I love this.
Oh, yeah, I think that's a clean one. That's like a typical comic insecurity joke. There's this comic, he's in the bar Friday night, and he's done working, and there's this really the most stunningly beautiful woman he's ever seen in his life sitting at the bar, and she says, you were so funny tonight. I never laughed so hard. I think you're the sexiest guy in the world. I want to take you back to my place and make the hottest love with you and just give you the wildest sexual trip you've ever had in your whole entire life right now. And he looks at her and he goes, did you see the first show or the second show?
That is so great. I've heard that for jazz musicians too, where the beautiful woman comes up to a jazz musician and he says, so did you hear the first set or the second set?
Yeah.
it's the best joke about self-absorbed artists I've heard.
There's a lot of those going around.
Yeah, yeah. You know, in your book, you seem to really want to communicate that you're not the TV character, Drew Carey, that he's a lot more lovable than you really are.
The guy on TV puts up with so much more crap than I would ever put up with in my life. And I have so much more ambition in my real life than the guy on TV does. You know, if that was the real Drew, I would have quit that job and try to start my own business. And, you know, I mean, a real business where I could make money. Buzz Beer isn't going so good on this show. But, I mean, when you're writing a book, it's like a personal letter, you know, almost to strangers. And so you want to let them know, like, hey, this is me, and I'm not, you know, you want to write it in your own voice and try to be some TV guy. Because I think the book, you know, I'm writing it, it was scaring me that the book might be around more than the TV show, you know. The book can sit around for a long time after the TV show's come and gone. It can be sitting on somebody's bookshelf in a library, you know, who knows.
Yeah, but the reruns come back to haunt you anyways.
Yeah, I know, but yeah, hopefully.
That's right, if you're lucky.
In a perfect world, yeah.
Well, another thing you point out in your book is that, you know, comics have to make fun of people. It's hard to be, like, the nicest guy if you're a comic.
They have to. You have to make fun of people and ruffle some feathers, or why be a comic? I hate watching comics that have no opinion about anything. Because I'll watch comics on TV, and if they have strong opinions, and even if I disagree with the opinion, if I'm laughing, I don't care.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they could have the strongest, most out there, outrageous, you know, even hateful opinions about, you know, certain types of people, certain groups of people. And if I'm in that group, you know, if I'm still laughing, that's a great comic. That's the kind of stuff I love. I hate a guy who's, or a woman either, who's wishy-washy about their opinion and just doesn't, takes a middle road and tries not to offend people. It doesn't have to be dirty. Like even like Bill Cosby in mm-hmm. his albums, when he's telling his stories and stuff, it's a strong point of view. And he has a real strong, certain opinion about his brother, about his mom and dad, about, you know, things that scare him, about things he thought when he was a child, you know, when he's telling those kind of stories, or as an adult, as a parent. And even then, it's a strong opinion behind it. He's not, there's no wishy-washiness behind anything he says when he's doing that. It's a real conviction. And that's what you look for. So that's important to have. And if you don't do that, you shouldn't be in the comedy business.
Now, comparing the real Drew Carey to the TV character of Drew Carey, you said that you're okay. A lot more ambitious and not quite as lovable as a TV character. What are the other differences?
I might be as lovable, but, you know, I'm not like...
We'll be the judge of that.
You know. Yeah, okay. I mean, I'm a friendly guy.
The TV Drew has to wear a suit to work every day, and in fact, you're wearing yes. a suit on the cover of your book, but I doubt you yeah. wear a suit when you're off the set.
No, I heard that suit on the book cover came from wardrobe, actually. That's a borrowed suit. Every time I need something, like when I'm doing a Tonight Show or I'm doing an interview where I need a suit, I go to the wardrobe department and they make me up a suit. I own like 4 suits in real life. That's right. In my closet. Yeah. And so, and one of them, I actually went out and bought a Versace jacket and shirt for the ABC premiere announcement ceremonies when they announced their fall shows.
Uh-huh.
And I got away with telling a really bad taste Versace joke in front of all the, because of it, in front of all the TV critics at the TV Critics Award show, at their award ceremony. Right in front of Angelica Houston, she looked like I just shot her.
What was the joke?
It's really what I thought too. I bought this Versace jacket. It was $800. It was the most money I ever spent on a jacket in my life. Because I'm not a big suit buyer, and I thought, or a clothes buyer. I go to the Gap and stuff. So it's a really expensive jacket. I figured, what the hell? I'm going to be in New York. It's ABC, you know, and a big thing. So I bought this shirt, and the shirt was real expensive, like, you know, over $100, and the jacket was $800, and. When I got it to New York, I didn't wear it until I got it to New York. When I got it to New York, I went to try it on and put it on to go out to this party, and the button fell off in my hand. And so when I heard he got shot, I thought, good.
Oh, jeez. I could see why this would have bombed.
That'll yeah. teach him. Mm. It got a big laugh, actually. But Angelica Houston looked at me like I just shot her.
So what are your standards for stuff like that, about when it's just unthinkable to tell a joke like that and when it's a decent idea?
That joke I had to tell like right after it happened, you know, like right after he got shot, I had to tell that joke. Cause then the attitude is, I'm not making such a big deal. I was happy he was shot just because, you know, his clothing was so cheap and the button came off in my hand, you know, for such a stupid reason. That's what made it so funny to me. Plus I have a different attitude about death than most people have. It doesn't bother me. You know, I think, you know, if you believe in a heaven and all that stuff, if, you know, when you die on earth, it shouldn't be something to be sad about. It should be a happy thing that you're going on to a better place, and there's nothing really to cry about or be sad about, you know. So I don't, especially when you've lived such a great life, you know. Versace had such a great life. He was loved by everybody, and from what I read about him, he was, you know, really generous to his friends and was happy. And, you know, when you live a life like that, when it ends, you know, at least he liked to live a good life and have nice things around him. You know, it's not like some, you know, poor starving bum died and never had a chance to do anything and never achieved any goal or knew what a goal was. That's the person you should be sad about. You think, oh, this poor guy died without even knowing what fun was, you know. So at least Versace had a good time before he got shot.
My guest is Drew Carey. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Drew Carey, star of the sitcom The Drew Carey Show and author of the new book, Dirty Jokes and Beer. Now, in your book, you say that, you know, another difference between you and the TV version of you is that in real life, you date strippers now that you can.
Now that I can, yeah.
Is it hard to date strippers?
I'm not the jealous type of person. If you're really a jealous type of guy, a stripper would be a bad person for you to date because you'd be all over to quit your job and not do anything. I mean, I don't date just strippers, you know, but I have dated strippers. They're really fun. I think generally, all in all, I think strippers are really, they're fun. They're open-minded. They're always out for a laugh and a good time. You know, they don't mind being naked.
Drew Carey, in your book, you confess that you had your nipples pierced, and, you know, you didn't strike me as the nipple-piercing kind of guy.
I know, that's always shocks people. It's just after I did the pilot of the show and waiting to hear if it got picked up or not, and it's really like this gray zone limbo that you're in, you know, and you never know what's going to happen to you. Like, your whole career is on the line, and I was just in this weird mood, and I was... with some friend of mine who's a stripper, and she thought it'd be great if I got my nipples pierced, and so she was beautiful, and she said, hey, pierce your nipples, and that's all it took. I said, yeah, sure, whatever you say, and I had a couple margaritas, and we went down to this place, and I got them both done. I only have one now, because the other one was put in, like, too close to the skin, I think, and it hurt all the time, so I had it taken out, but the other one I have in, it's still in there. I figured I'd put up with it. I put up with the initial pain. I'm not going to get rid of it now.
Do you think you've managed to transform the 1950s square look into something really hip?
Maybe. You know, the only reason when I first started doing the act, I had the crew cut already and the glasses already from the Marine Corps Reserves. And I wore contact lenses when I was at work being a waiter. And then when I got off work, I take the contacts out and I put on my goofy glasses. I never knew how bad they looked until I started going on stage with them and people would laugh at me. The suit I bought at a Goodwill and... because that movie Stop Making Sense had just been out, and I thought, if I got a big, you know, old style suit, that would be really hip to wear, and I look so bad in it, I can never wear it out. And I only wore it on stage to see if it would get a laugh for me, and it did. And it's not like I really tried all that hard to create a character, because it was pretty much just me in a Goodwill suit that I'd already bought, you know, before I just started doing stand up. But it might be a look. I don't know. Who knows?
Did the Marines make you wear those glasses?
Those are the official glasses. They have different ones now, but I think they let guys wear a certain kind of wires now. But then those were the official government-issued glasses. And when you had an inspection and stuff, that's what you had to wear. And during your work day, you could wear wire rims, you know. But for inspections and stuff like that, you had to wear the black, ugly. In the Marines, they call them, all through the service, they call them birth control glasses.
That's funny.
BCGs, yeah. And that's exactly why, too. They're so ugly.
You write in your book that, you don't know what humiliation is until you've shown up on your first day of junior high with moon boots and a snowsuit that your mother got on sale during the summer. Did your mother dress you badly when you were young?
No, it's just that, she would. She would buy, like, the winter stuff on sale during the summer because that's when it's the cheapest. And she'd buy, Christmas stuff for next year after Christmas when it all goes on sale before it gets all put away. And so... you don't get the coolest stuff all the time when your mom's shopping like that because, we didn't have a lot of money growing up. But it's cold, man. I'm telling you, it gets cold in the winter in Cleveland. So you have to wear what you can to keep warm. I remember mom used to say, do you want to look good or do you want to stay warm? And then after you get to be about 14 or 15, you think, heck, I'm not even wearing a hat. That was like the big thing in my high school. Nobody wore a hat no matter what, no matter how cold. They would all let, I would come home from wrestling practice or gym or whatever, my hair would be wet still, and I'd walk home, I would refuse to put a hat on because I didn't want to get hat hair. I have icicles in my hair. It'd be like the stupidest thing. And everybody in my school was like that except for the nerds, They would wear the hats, and I didn't want to be one of them.
Right. Ooh, where would you have fit yourself in those days?
I don't know. I never, I was always pretty well known and pretty popular. I mean, I was one of those kids that walked down the hall in high school without a pass, and everybody knew me.
Right.
And all my friends were really funny, and I hung out with a group of guys that were all really funny and liked to joke around a lot and play pranks and stuff. So I was in whatever that group is. That's the group I was in. And I wasn't very athletic, And I didn't want to go through high school without trying out for a sport. There was an announcement over the loudspeaker one day: any boys interested in trying out for wrestling, come to the gym and bring your gym clothes. And so I tried out for wrestling. For 2 years I went to wrestling practice. Never even wrestled JV. I was really bad, but I really liked it. It taught me a lot, about sticking to it and stuff. But it was like, I'm glad I had a sport experience in high school. And then I graduated a year early, so I only had the 2 years, and I skipped my senior year.
Hmm.
So I wasn't very athletic. I didn't do anything great that way. And then academically, I wasn't so hot. I got a B average, without even trying. I mean, you just have to show up for class and take the test.
Well, you were funny in high school. Did you say to yourself, well, I could do this professionally?
I always say no in interviews, but then when I had a development deal at Disney once, and they were thinking of doing a show about me, and had my mom send out all these pictures of me from when I was a kid and all this stuff. She has like a little file about, you know, like every mom does. And so one of the things in this file that she sent was, I think I wrote it when I was 14 or so, judging from the handwriting, and it was on steno paper, and I wrote down like things I wanted to do with my life or be, you know, and on this list was stuff like, I want to be on the Johnny Carson show. I want to be a stand-up. I want to be a nightclub comic. I want to have a sitcom. I want to, you know, I want to star in a situation comedy or a play or something like that. It was all these kind of things that I'm doing now that I wrote down when I was 14, and then I just forgot about.
That's interesting.
You know,
yeah.
It freaked me out. It really freaked me out. I had no idea, you know, because I didn't know what I wanted to do. When I started doing stand-up comedy in my late 20s, I didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. I had no goals, no direction, nothing. I just kind of fell into it. And so to see that list from when I was like 14 or 15 or whatever, however I was old when I wrote it, and I was like, wow, it must have been in the back of my mind somewhere.
Maybe you forgot it, you know? Because it seems like such a long shot that it, you know, you didn't take it seriously.
Yeah, it was like one of these like big, it's like, you know, there was also stuff like, you know, pet a pony, you know, so. But it was like, I used to watch, when I was in junior high and high school, I used to watch The Tonight Show all the time if there was a comic on. I wouldn't watch the Johnny Carson show normally, only if there was a comic.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd always look at the TV guide and if it said comedian so-and-so, and I'd always make sure I'd watch and see who the comic was. And I think that's where I got the idea that, oh, I would love to do that someday. And I wrote down, you know, be a nightclub comic, be on the Johnny Carson show. And it all came true. I can't believe, you know, it's weird.
What was your first brush with professional comedy?
Just doing the... working at one club in Canton. I lived in Cleveland, and the guy that owned the Cleveland club owned a club in Canton. He put me in his Canton club for a week. 9 shows for $100. That was my first professional paid gig. I got like $10 a show.
What was your first time on stage like?
Oh, the very first time I ever tried to do jokes on stage, I was living in Las Vegas, and it was horrible. I was terrible. I tried, you know, I didn't know how to write jokes. I just, you know, it's kind of like jokes that I kind of heard, and you know, observations that weren't funny, that were like, oh my god, it was like the worst. I still have notes from those days that I save, and oh my god, the worst. Ugh, I can't tell you how bad. That was in like in 79, and then like in 8, I just did it as a goof just to see what it would be like. It was the Sahara Talent Showcase at the Sahara Hotel, their lounge. They let anybody get up there. And and then I, you know, I went to Cleveland in 80, and there was a guy starting a comedy club there, and late 79, early 80, and he wanted local comics, and he just put me on just for, because I could breathe and stand up and talk. And I remember the very first time, he didn't pay the MCs, he only paid the headliners. I didn't get any money, but he worked me once, and I remember the first night I did, it was Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and the first night I did 5 minutes, or 10 minutes, supposed to do 10 minutes. Then Friday, they said, why don't you do just 5? And then Saturday, they said, look, don't do any time, just bring the other guys up. They cut me down. They didn't want me to just do anything, because I was that bad. I think I did it twice. And then I said, well, I can't do this. This is silly. You know, at least I tried it and got it out of my system. I was going to college then and everything. And I thought, I'll just, you know, I did it as a goof. I got it out of my system. I won't try it again. And I never did. And I thought, well, that was just it. So then later on in 86, when my, you know, in late 85, my friend said, hey, he remembered from when I used to be I met him when I tried to do stand-up. He always thought it was funny. And when I was having trouble, you know, paying rent, I got in a fight with my boss where I was waiting tables. And he said, hey, if you want to think of any jokes for my radio show, I'll pay you. I went, oh, how much? And he gives $20 a joke or so. And I thought, oh, I can make an extra $100 a week. And I went to the library and I finally got a book on how to write jokes. And from reading that book, that's what really started me. I thought, oh, wow, there's a formula to this. I could write jokes.
How did the book help you write jokes?
There's formulas for every kind of joke writing. I mean, there really is.
Give me an example.
Easily learned. Well, the example they used in the book, the first example I used was they take driving. You write driving at the top of the page, and then you write down. It's all about list making, joke writing, writing one-liners. It's all about list making. So you write driving, then you write down everything you can think of that relates to driving. You know, angry drivers, slow drivers, fast drivers. You know, new cars, old cars, junk cars. You know, car washes. You know, red lights. And you write all this stuff down, and then you try to there's you try to exaggerate something to make it bigger than it is. You try to use plays on words. If there's words that sound like other words, you try to make puns up that way. You can make jokes like that. And you use all these different techniques to take these little, all these little lists you made, you know, and even angry women drivers, you know. And you try to, when you detail it down, you try to make every little thing and exaggerate it or minimalize it or twist it around. And then you try to make like, you know, 20 jokes and try to get one good joke out of that. And that's how you come up with one good joke. It should take, you know, if you're starting out, it takes you like 3 hours.
I can't believe you actually honed your technique through through a book.
Yeah. I'm really big on self-help, you know, so I always try to get a book at the library or a book on whatever I want to learn. I try to learn it from some kind of book.
Now, I know when you were younger, you studied accordion, trumpet, and you sang in the school choir. Do you still play anything?
I don't know why. The last couple of years, I've had this bug to go do everything I did when I was in high school that I quit doing because I just got bored with it or for whatever reason. And I bought a really expensive accordion. I bought a MIDI accordion that I can hook up to a MIDI board and make it sound like, you know, trumpets and violins and all that stuff. And I bought a real expensive trumpet. I practice my trumpet all the time. I played the trumpet on a show, an episode that's coming up pretty soon. I got to play Taste of Honey by Herb Albert.
Oh, no. God, I remember that version of it, too.
Yeah. We tried to get Herb Albert to do the show. He wasn't available. We tried to get him on as a can't. We were going to show him just looking up at the bar while I was playing and just walking out really sad.
Drew Carey, his new book is called Dirty Jokes and Beer. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.